Welcome to this deep dive. If you're a small business owner, maybe self-employed, or, you know, even just curious about the best ways to save for retirement, well, you're definitely in the right place today.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be pulling apart the world of small business retirement plans, specifically SEP, simple and qualified plans. We're using the official guidance, IRS Publication 560, looking at the rules for 2024 tax returns.
Right.
Our mission really is simple. To give you the core understanding of what these plans actually are, how much you can potentially contribute, and the tax implications. We'll try to do it without getting totally lost in the jargon.
Exactly. Think of it as your shortcut to understanding these really crucial retirement savings vehicles. We know it can seem pretty complex out there.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, we're here to sort of extract the essential info, help you see which path might be, you know, the right fit for your particular situation.
Okay, fantastic. Let's unpack this then. Maybe starting with the SEP plans. What's the core idea behind those?
Yeah, SEP Simplified Employee Pension Plan. It really focuses on ease, right? It's designed as a straightforward way for employers, and that includes self-employed folks, to make contributions.
With themselves and employees.
For themselves and their employees, yeah. Towards retirement savings.
Mm-hmm.
The setup itself is generally simpler than many other options. You just need to adopt a formal SEP agreement.
Okay.
Unlike some of the qualified plans we'll talk about later, which might involve setting up a trust.
Right. So maybe less red tape to get started. And the money itself, where does it actually end up going?
So contributions go directly into a traditional SEP IRA that's set up for each eligible employee. Now, here's where it gets kind of interesting with a pretty recent update.
Yeah.
Thanks to the Secure 2.0 Act of 2022, starting back in 2023, a SEP plan can now actually allow employees to choose to have their contributions go into a Roth IRA instead, which creates what's known as a Roth SEP IRA. So it gives employees that choice in how their savings are taxed down the line.
That Roth option, yeah, that seems like valuable flexibility, especially for employees thinking about, you know, their future tax situation.
Definitely.
Okay, now let's switch gears a bit. Simple plans. What makes them different from SEPs?
Right. Simple plans. That stands for Savings Incentive Match Plan for employees. Generally, these are designed for, let's say, smaller businesses, typically those with 100 or fewer employees,
okay,
who earned at least $5,000 in compensation in the previous year. A key feature, a real defining feature of simple plans, is that employees can choose to make salary reduction contributions.
So they're choosing to put money in directly from their paycheck.
Exactly. It's like they're deciding, okay, take this portion of my paycheck before taxes typically and put it into my retirement account.
Gotcha. So with a simple plan, it sounds like both the employee and the employer are usually contributing.
That's usually the case, yeah. On top of what the employee puts in, the employer is actually required to make either matching contributions or what are called non-elective contributions.
Okay, what's the difference there? Matching versus non-elective.
So matching means the employer matches a certain amount of what the employee contributes up to a limit. Non-elective means the employer contributes a set percentage for eligible employees, even if the employee doesn't contribute anything themselves.
Right.
And employers also have the option to make additional non-elective contributions if they want. Typically, all these contributions go into an employee's traditional simple IRA.
But I'm guessing there's a Roth option here too now.
You guessed it. Mirroring that SEP update under Secure 2.0, starting after 2022, employees in a simple plan can also choose to have their contributions directed into a Roth IRA, creates a Roth simple IRA.
Right.
And like you said with SEPs, this Roth option, it can be particularly appealing maybe for younger employees who think they might be in a higher tax bracket later in retirement.
Yeah, that makes sense. Seems like a valuable trend across these plans, adding that Roth flexibility. What about the timing? If a business owner is thinking, okay, a simple might work for me, when do they need to actually set it up? Is there a deadline?
There is, generally. To set up a simple IRA plan for a particular calendar year, you typically need to do it between January 1st and October 1st of that year.
Okay, so most of the year, but not right at the end.
Right. There's a slight exception, though. If you're a new employer, maybe starting your business after October 1st, you get a little more time. You can set up the plan as soon as it's practically feasible after your business begins.
Okay.
But one key point.
Yep.
The plan's effective date cannot be before the date you actually adopt the plan document.
Good to know, especially for those launching later in the year. All right, let's talk numbers.
Yeah.
Contribution limits for simple plans in 2024. What can employees put in And what about the employers?
Okay, for 2024, employees can generally contribute up to $16,000 through salary reduction.
$16,000.
Yep. And that limit's actually set to nudge up slightly to $16,500 in 2025. Now, interestingly, that Secure 2.0 Act we keep mentioning, it also allows for a potentially higher limit. It could be up to $17,600 for certain employers in 2024, depending on their setup.
Okay. And how does an employee decide how much? Is it a percentage or a dollar amount?
It can be either. Usually it's expressed as a percentage of their pay, but employers can also permit employees to choose a specific dollar amount if they prefer. Importantly, the employer can't really restrict how much an employee contributes, you know, other than making sure it complies with these overall limits.
Right. And what about the employer side? You mentioned matching and non-elective contributions. What are the rules or limits there?
Sure. For employer matching, the sort of standard approach is they match up to 3% of the employee's compensation.
3%.
Yes. But again, Secure 2.0 potentially allows for higher matching contributions for certain employers, particularly those who also allow those higher employee salary reduction contributions we just mentioned.
Okay.
For the non-elective option, the employer can choose instead to contribute 2% of compensation. This goes to each eligible employee who earned at least $5,000 or a lower amount if the employer sets it lower during the year. And that's regardless of whether the employee contributes anything themselves.
So that's guaranteed money for the employee if the employer chooses that route.
Exactly. And similar to matching, higher non-elective contributions might be available in certain situations under Secure 2.0 as well. One more number to keep in mind here.
Okay.
For calculating these employer contributions in 2024, only up to $345,000 of an employee's compensation can actually be considered. That number goes up to $350,000 in 2025.
$345,000. That's a pretty high cap. So while the $16,000 employee limit might be fine for some, maybe owners wanting to max out their own savings might look elsewhere eventually.
That's a really good point. You know, consider your long-term financial goals. If you anticipate significant business growth or really want to maximize your personal savings potential, the potentially higher limits in some qualified plans might become more appealing down the road. It's worth weighing those limits against your future plans.
Makes sense. Okay, so we have several ways money can go into a simple plan. What are the tax benefits? How do these contributions get treated at tax time?
Good question. For the employer, their contributions, whether matching or non-elective, are generally tax deductible for the business. That's a nice benefit.
Right.
For employees contributing to a traditional simple IRA, their salary reduction contributions are excluded from their gross income for federal income tax purposes right now.
So pre-tax.
Pre-tax, exactly. They don't pay income tax on that money today. However, and this is important, those salary reductions are still subject to Social Security, Medicare, and FUTA taxes.
Ah, okay. So not completely tax-free on the way in.
Correct. Now, on the other hand, the employer's matching and non-elective contributions going into that traditional simple IRA are not subject to those employment taxes.
Okay, that's a useful distinction.
Right.
What about the Roth simple IRA then? How are contributions taxed there? Is it just flipped?
Pretty much, yeah. For salary reduction contributions going into a Roth simple IRA, it's the opposite. Those contributions are included in the employee's gross income now.
So after tax.
After tax. And they are subject to federal income tax withholding, plus Social Security, Medicare, railroad retirement, if applicable, and FUTA taxes. So the employee pays the taxes on that money up front.
But the benefit comes later, right?
Exactly. The potential benefit is that qualified withdrawals in retirement are generally tax-free. And just like with the traditional simple, the employer's matching and non-elective contributions that go into a Roth simple IRA are not subject to those employment taxes.
Got it. So that classic Roth trade-off, pay taxes now for potential tax-free growth and withdrawals later. How does all this show up on tax forms like the W-2?
Okay, reporting. When it comes to salary reduction contributions going into a traditional simple IRA, that amount is actually not included in the wages figure in box one of the form W-2.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Instead, it is included in the Social Security wages and Medicare wages and tips boxes. And it's also reported over in box 12, usually with code S. Plus, the retirement plan box in box 13 will be checked. For Roth contributions, those are included in box one wages and also reported in box 12, but often with a different code like AA or BEB. Essentially, you know, you'll receive or need to provide specific tax forms documenting all these contributions. It ensures everyone, including the IRS, has a clear record. We can definitely point you to the specific forms if needed, but that's the gist of it.
That's helpful. Okay, that feels like a good handle on simple plans. Shall we move on to the next category? Qualified plans, specifically defined contribution plans. This sounds like maybe a broader and potentially more complex area.
Yeah, you could say that. Qualified defined contribution plans are definitely a wider group. They include things like profit sharing plans, money purchase pension plans, and probably the most well-known plans that include a 401k feature.
Right, 401k.
The big picture benefit, though, is similar to the SEPs and simples. They offer a tax-favored way to save for retirement. Employer contributions are deductible for the business. And the earnings on those contributions, and usually employee contributions too, generally grow tax-free or tax-deferred until retirement.
And that tax-deferred growth, that's where the real power can be over time, right?
Absolutely. It can make a huge difference over a long career.
So what's involved in actually setting up one of these qualified plans? Is it more work than a SEP or a simple?
Generally, yes. A bit more involved. Setting up a qualified plan involves a couple of key steps. First, you absolutely need to adopt a formal written plan document. These tend to be more detailed, more complex than a simple SEP or simple agreement.
Okay.
Second, you usually need to establish a way to hold the plan assets, often through a trust or custodial account. The employer holds the responsibility for both the initial setup and the ongoing administration of the plan, which, yeah, can definitely be more involved than with a SEP or simple. More rules to follow.
Gotcha. And when do the contributions need to be made for these types of plans? Are the deadlines different again?
The timing, yeah, it does vary a bit depending on the type of contribution we're talking about. For elective deferrals, that's the money employees choose to put in, like in a 401k.
Right.
The deadline for the employer to deposit those funds is generally tied to when payroll is processed, often very quickly. But for the employee to make the election, that has to happen during the plan year. The employer's deduction timing relates to their tax return due date, including extensions.
Okay. So there are Department of Labor rules about depositing employee money quickly.
Exactly. Especially for 401k, the DOL has rules requiring employee deferrals to be deposited into the plan as soon as administratively feasible, but no later than the 15th business day of the month following the month the money was withheld. There are some exceptions, like for solo or owner-only 401ks, which might have different timing rules related to the tax return deadline, so you really need to check those specific regulations.
Okay, good flag. What about when the employer makes their contributions, like profit sharing or matching?
Right. For employer contributions, the deadline differs slightly again. For profit sharing plans, including employer matches in a 401k, the deadline to make the contribution and still deduct it for the prior year generally aligns with the employer's tax return due date, including extensions.
Okay, similar to SEPs there.
Yeah. But for money purchase pension plans, the deadline is actually a bit later. It's specifically 8.5 months after the end of the plan year.
8.5 months. Why the difference?
Money purchase plans have required funding obligations each year, so there's a slightly longer window to make sure those specific funding requirements are met. Profit sharing is usually discretionary.
Got it. And employee contributions, if they're allowed outside of deferrals.
Right. If there are voluntary employee contributions, those generally need to be made by the end of the tax year. For owner employees contributing for themselves, though, there's often flexibility to make those contributions up until the tax return filing deadline, including extensions similar to SEP contributions.
Okay. It definitely sounds like more moving parts with the timing compared to SEP and simple. What about the contribution limits? You hinted these might be higher for qualified defined contribution plans in 2024.
Yes, typically qualified plans do allow for potentially higher contributions, which is a big draw for many businesses and owners.
Okay, let's hear the numbers.
All right. For employee elective deferrals in 2024, the money the employee puts into their 401k, for instance, the limit is
$23,000. $23,000. That's quite a bit higher than the simple limit.
It is. And if you're age 50 or over by the end of the year, you can add a catch-up contribution. For 2024, that catch-up is an additional $7,500, bringing the total possible deferral to $30,500.
Wow, yeah.
Then you have the overall limit. This includes both employee deferrals and employer contributions, like matching or profit sharing. For 2024, the total contribution for any single participant can't exceed the lesser of $69,000 or 100% of the participant's compensation.
$69,000. Okay, that's a significant potential.
It really is. But just like with simples, there's that compensation cap to remember. For calculating both employee and employer contributions in 2024, the maximum compensation that can be considered is, again, $345,000.
Right, same cap. So if you're looking to truly maximize retirement savings, especially for owners or higher earners, these qualified plans generally offer that much greater capacity.
That's the key takeaway, yes. More potential for savings, but also generally more complex administration.
Okay. Now, when are these contributions actually considered made for tax purposes? Is it always just the date the cash changes hands?
Generally, yes. Contributions are applied to the year in which they're actually made. However, there's a helpful provision, especially for employer contributions. You can treat them as if they were made for the previous tax year, provided you meet a few conditions. First, you have to actually make the contribution by the due date of your tax return for that previous year, including any extensions.
All right.
Second, the plan itself must have been established by the end of that previous year. You can't create it retroactively. Third, the plan needs to treat the contributions as if it received them on the last day of that previous year. And finally, you need to either specify in writing to the plan administrator or trustee that the contribution is for the previous year, or simply claim the deduction for it on your previous year's tax return.
So some flexibility there for year-end tax planning.
Exactly. It can be quite useful.
Are there any specific rules or maybe things to avoid when making contributions to these qualified plans? Any pitfalls?
Yes, definitely. One very important point. An employer's promissory note, basically an IOU made out to the plan, is not considered a qualified payment. In fact, it's generally classified as a prohibited transaction, which can lead to significant tax penalties. So you need to contribute actual cash or property.
Good to know. No IOUs. What else?
Also, there are limits on how much an employer can actually deduct for their contributions to defined contribution plans. The total deduction can't be more than 25% of the total compensation paid or accrued during the year to all eligible employees participating in the plan.
25% of total payroll for participants.
Essentially, yes. And self-employed individuals, they need to do a special calculation to figure this limit for their own contributions, factoring in their deduction for one half of self-employment tax. It gets a bit circular.
Right, the self-employed calculation. We touched on the employee deferral limits earlier, the $23,000 for 2024. Are there any overarching limits if someone participates in, say, multiple retirement plans, maybe a 401k at work and their own SEPI?
Absolutely. That $23,000 limit for 2024, it's an overall limit. It applies to the total amount an individual employee can elect to defer across all plans they participate in that allow elective deferrals.
So across their 401k, maybe a 403b, even a simple IRA.
Exactly. All those employee elective deferrals count towards that single $23,000 limit, or $30,500 with catch-up. This limit increases to $23,500 for 2025, by the way. And this applies regardless of community property laws between spouses.
Okay, so you can't double dip just because you have multiple jobs or plans.
Correct. You need to track your total deferrals across all sources.
And just to confirm, those catch-up contributions for folks 50 and over, those are definitely available in these qualified 401k plans.
Yes, absolutely. For 401k plans and similar plans like 403bs and governmental 457bs, participants who are age 50 or over by the end of the calendar year can make those additional catch-up contributions.
And it was $7,500 for 2024.
$7,500 for both 2024 and 2025. It's a great way for older workers to boost their savings as they get closer to retirement.
Definitely. What happens if someone messes up? Maybe they participate in two plans and accidentally contribute more than a $23,000 limit. What are the consequences of those excess deferrals?
Yeah, that can happen. If an employee makes excess deferrals, contributes more than that overall limit, those excess amounts, plus any earnings on them, must be distributed back to the employee from the plan.
Okay. Is there a deadline for that?
Yes. Crucially, the distribution needs to happen by April 15th of the year following the year the excess default was made.
April 15th. Why is that deadline so important?
Because if the excess is distributed by April 15th, it's taxed in the year it was contributed, the year of the excess. But if you miss that deadline, the excess amount gets taxed both in the year it was contributed and again when it's eventually distributed later on.
Ouch. Double taxation.
Exactly. You want to avoid that. Plus, failing to correct excess deferrals in some situations could even potentially jeopardize the plan's qualified status. So tracking those limits and correcting any excesses promptly is really important. These corrective distributions are reported on Form 1099 to Shaver R.
Good to know. Handle it by April 15th. Now, 401k plans within these qualified plans, Sometimes they get complicated with non-discrimination testing, right?
Mm.
Ensuring fairness between higher paid and lower paid employees.
That's right. Many traditional 401k plans are subject to annual testing, specifically the actual deferral percentage, ADP test, and the actual contribution percentage, ACP test.
ABP and ACP.
Yeah. These tests basically compare the average contribution rates of the highly compensated employees, HCEs, to those of the non-highly compensated employees, NHCEs.
And if the HCEs contribute a lot more on average.
If the averages are too far apart, the plan can fail the tests. This can lead to corrective actions, like distributing excess contributions back to the HCEs or requiring the employer to make additional contributions for the NHCEs. It can be an administrative headache and potentially limit how much HCEs can save.
Okay, so are there ways to simplify this, to avoid that testing?
Yes, there are. Safe Harbor 401k plans are specifically designed for this purpose. They allow a plan to automatically satisfy or pass the ADP and ACP tests.
Ah, Safe Harbor. Sounds nice.
Yeah.
How does that work? What does the employer have to do?
To qualify as a Safe Harbor plan, the employer must agree to make certain minimum contributions for the non-highly compensated employees. These contributions must also be 100% vested immediately.
Okay, what kind of contributions are we talking about?
There are two main options. The first is a matching contribution. A common formula is the employer matches 100% of employee deferrals up to the first 3% of their compensation, plus 50% of deferrals on the next 2%, between 3% and 5% of pay.
Okay, so a potential 4% match if the employee defers 5%.
Exactly. And importantly, under this option, the matching rate provided to any highly compensated employee cannot be greater than the rate provided to non-highly compensated employees.
Got it. What's the second option?
The second option is a non-elective contribution. Here, the employer contributes at least 3% of compensation for all eligible non-highly compensated employees, regardless of whether those employees make any deferrals themselves.
So 3% across the board for the NHCEs, even if they don't save anything.
That's right. By committing to one of these formulas and meeting certain notice requirements for employees, the plan avoids that complex ADPCP testing. It provides more certainty for planning and reduces administrative burden.
That sounds like a really valuable feature, especially for businesses that want predictability and want to encourage participation. What about getting money out of these 401k plans?
Uh-huh.
Are there restrictions on when employees can actually access the funds?
Generally, yes. These are retirement savings plans, so the rules are designed to keep the money in until retirement. Distributions from 401k plans are typically not allowed until certain events occur.
Such as
the employee reaching retirement age, often 59 and a half were the plan's normal retirement age, death, disability, or severance from employment with that employer. Plan termination is another trigger, but only if the employer doesn't establish a successor-defined contribution plan.
Okay. What about before retirement? Any options?
For 401k plans that are part of a profit-sharing plan structure, distributions might also be permitted when the employee simply reaches age 59 and a half, even if still working, or potentially in cases of documented financial hardship.
Ah, hardship withdrawals. Are those easy to get?
Not always. Hardship withdrawals have very specific IRS rules defining what constitutes an immediate and heavy financial need, and the withdrawal is usually limited to the amount needed to satisfy that need. Plus, they are often still subject to income tax and potentially the 10% early withdrawal penalty. So they're really meant as a last resort.
Okay, so generally designed for long-term savings. We also mentioned money purchase pension plans earlier as a type of qualified plan. Are there any unique rules about funding for those specific plans?
Yes, money purchase pension plans are a bit different from profit sharing plans or 401ks in that they have mandatory annual funding requirements. The employer must contribute a predetermined amount or percentage of compensation each year, as specified in the plan document.
So not discretionary like profit sharing.
Exactly. Because of this mandatory funding, they are subject to minimum funding standards under the law, which often necessitates making quarterly installment payments throughout the year.
Quarterly payments.
Yes. However, as we noted earlier on deadlines, there is an extended period for actually making the total contribution to satisfy that minimum funding obligation up to 8.5 months after the end of the plan year. But the requirement for regular fixed contributions is a key characteristic.
Got it. Another aspect of qualified plans sometimes mentioned is survivor benefits. What are the rules around those? Is the spouse protected?
Yes, many qualified plans, particularly pension plans like money purchase plans and defined benefit plans, which we aren't covering in detail today, are required by law to provide automatic survivor benefits for the participant's spouse.
Automatic benefits.
Yes. These typically come in two forms. First, a joint and survivor annuity, QJSA, for retirement benefits. This means that when the participant retires, their benefit is paid as an annuity over their life and the life of their surviving spouse.
Okay, so payments continue to the spouse after the participant dies.
Correct, usually at a certain percentage, often 50% or 100%. The second form is a pre-retirement survivor annuity, QPSA. This provides an annuity to the surviving spouse if the participant dies before reaching retirement age, but after becoming vested in their benefits.
I see. So protection both before and after retirement starts.
Right. And if a plan is required to offer these automatic survivor benefits, then spousal consent is generally needed for a few things.
Like what?
Like if the participant wants to take out a loan from the plan that's secured by their accrued benefit, the spouse usually has to agree. Also, if the participant wants to waive these survivor benefit options, maybe they want a lump sum instead of an annuity or want to name a different beneficiary, the spouse generally must provide written notarized consent.
So some real protections built in for the spouse.
Definitely. It's designed to ensure the surviving spouse has some financial security from the plan.
Okay. And what about those top-heavy rules we sometimes hear about? When do those kick in and what are the implications? Sounds ominous.
Huh, yeah, top-heavy sounds a bit dramatic. It's a set of rules designed to ensure that plans don't disproportionately benefit the owners and most highly paid employees, known as key employees, at the expense of the rank-and-file workers.
Okay, so another fairness rule. Mm. When is a plan considered top-heavy?
A plan is generally considered top-heavy for a plan year if the total value of the plan accounts or accrued benefits for the key employees exceeds 60% of the total value of all accounts or benefits under the plan.
60%. Who counts as a key employee?
Key employees typically include certain officers of the company making over a specific compensation threshold, individuals who own more than 5% of the business, and individuals who own more than 1% of the business and have compensation over $150,000. There are also rules about family attribution of ownership.
Okay. So if the plan is mostly benefiting these key employees, what happens?
If a plan is determined to be top-heavy for a year, it generally must provide certain minimum contributions or benefits to all the non-key employees participating in the plan for that year.
Minimum contributions, like how much?
For defined contribution plans, like the ones we're focusing on, the minimum contribution is usually 3% of compensation for each non-key employee, or if less, the highest contribution rate provided to any key employee for that year. This minimum contribution must be made even if the non-key employee doesn't contribute themselves, and it has specific vesting requirements, too.
So it forces a minimum benefit for the non-key folks if the plan is tilted towards the top. Exactly. It ensures they get at least something. However, there are some important exceptions. These top-heavy rules generally do not apply to simple IRA plans or simple 401k plans. They also typically don't apply to Safe Harbor 401k plans that meet the requirements using only those Safe Harbor contributions we discussed earlier. And certain plans with automatic enrollment features called QACAs, qualified automatic contribution arrangements, can also be exempt.
So using a simple or a Safe Harbor 401k can help avoid this complication too.
That's often another benefit of choosing those designs, yes.
Okay. One last area on qualified plans before we move to definitions, prohibited transactions. We mentioned the employer's IOU earlier. What are some other examples that small business owners really need to be careful to avoid?
Right. Prohibited transactions are essentially dealings between the plan and certain individuals or entities called disqualified persons. This category is broad. It includes the employer, plan fiduciaries, anyone with control over plan assets or administration, owners, highly compensated employees, relatives of these individuals, and companies they control.
So insiders, basically.
Pretty much. The rules exist to prevent potential conflicts of interest or self-dealing that could harm the plan and its participants.
Makes sense. What kind of transactions are prohibited?
Well, the list is quite extensive, but some key examples include any sale, exchange, or leasing of property between the plan and a disqualified person.
Cool.
Any lending of money or extension of credit between the plan and a disqualified person, except for properly structured participant loans that meet specific requirements.
Right.
Furnishing goods, services, or facilities between the plan and a disqualified person. Also, a transfer of any plan assets to a disqualified person or the use of plan assets by or for the benefit of a disqualified person. And a big one is a fiduciary dealing with the plan's assets in their own interest or for their own account, or acting on behalf of a party whose interests are adverse to the plan.
So basically, fiduciaries have to act solely in the interest of the plan participants.
Precisely. That's their fundamental duty. Now, it's worth noting there are some statutory and administrative exemptions to these rules. For instance, a disqualified person receiving benefits they are properly entitled to as a plan participant is not a prohibited transaction.
Okay, phew.
But yeah, it's definitely an area where it's best to err on the side of caution. Engaging in a prohibited transaction can result in significant excise taxes levied against the disqualified person involved and potentially other penalties. If you're ever unsure if a transaction might be prohibited, seeking guidance from a legal or financial professional specializing in ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, is highly recommended.
Absolutely. Sounds like an area where you don't want to make a mistake. Okay, there are a lot of detail on the three main types of plans: SIP, simple, and qualified. To help everyone keep it straight, maybe we should quickly clarify some of the key definitions that kept popping up.
Good idea. Yeah, these terms are important.
For instance, who exactly counts as an employer for these plan purposes? It might seem obvious, but are there nuances?
There can be. For retirement plan rules, an employer is generally anyone for whom an individual performs services as an employee under the common law definition. But importantly, a sole proprietor is considered both the employer and the employee.
Okay.
And in the case of a partnership, the partnership itself is treated as the employer of each partner. It's not the individual partners employing themselves, it's the partnership entity. This distinction matters for how contributions and deductions are handled.
Got it. Partnership is the employer of the partners. What about highly compensated employee, or HCE? That term came up a lot with testing and safe harbors. What are the criteria again?
Right. HCE status is key for non-discrimination rules. An employee is considered highly compensated if they meet one of two tests, generally based on the preceding year.
Okay.
Test one. Did they own more than 5% of the business interest at any time during the current year or the preceding year? Ownership alone makes them an HCE, regardless of pay.
More than 5% owner.
Got it. Test two. Did they receive compensation from the employer in the preceding year that was more than a specific dollar threshold? For determining HCE status in 2024, you look back at 2023 compensation. The threshold for 2023 was
$150,000. $150,000 in 2023 makes you an HCE in 2024.
Potentially. There's an optional second part to that second test. The employer can elect in their plan document to limit HCE status under this compensation test to only those employees who are also in the top 20% of employees when ranked by pay for that preceding year.
Ah, the top pay group election.
Exactly. So it's either 5% ownership or our compensation over the limit, which was $150,000 for 2023, is $155,000 for 2024 determining 2025 status, and $160,000 for 2025 determining 2026 status, potentially combined with being in the top 20% by pay if the figure elects that.
Okay, complex but important for testing. We also heard the term leased employee. How do they fit into the retirement plan picture? Are they counted?
Generally, yes, they might need to be. A leased employee, even if not a direct common law employee, often must be treated as your employee for retirement plan coverage and testing purposes if they meet three conditions.
What are the conditions?
One, they provide services to you under an agreement with an outside leasing organization. Two, they have performed services for you on a substantially full-time basis for at least 1 year. And three, their services are performed under your primary direction or control.
So long-term integrated workers, even if paid by someone else.
Pretty much. The idea is to prevent businesses from avoiding retirement plan obligations by just leasing workers long term instead of hiring them directly. However, there is an exception.
Okay.
You generally don't have to treat leased employees as your own for retirement plan purposes if those leased employees make up no more than 20% of your non-highly compensated workforce, and they are covered by a qualified pension plan maintained by the leasing organization that meets certain minimum requirements, like being a money purchase plan with at least a 10% contribution rate and immediate vesting.
Okay. So a potential out, but only if the leasing company provides a decent plan.
Correct. It's something to be aware of if you use leased employees extensively.
Okay. What about just participant? That seems straightforward, right? An employee in the plan.
Exactly. A participant is simply an eligible employee who is actually covered by the plan and has an account balance or accrued benefit. The plan document itself will define who is an eligible employee, often based on things like minimum age or completing a certain period of service.
Gotcha. And partners in a partnership, just to reiterate, how are they viewed again?
For retirement plan purposes, a partner is treated as an employee of the partnership. This is different from a sole proprietor who is their own employer. This employee status for partners affects how their contributions are made and deducted.
Right. Employee of the partnership. Lastly, that term net earnings from self-employment. This is super important for sole proprietors and partners figuring out their own contributions. Is the definition the same for all these plans?
Good question. It's actually slightly different, which can be tricky.
Oh, how so?
For SEP plans and qualified plans, like solo 401ks, your net earnings from self-employment are first calculated, and then you reduce that amount by the deduction for one half of your self-employment taxes. The retirement plan contribution you can make for yourself is then calculated based on this reduced net amount.
Okay, so contribution is based on earnings after the SE tax deduction.
Right. However, for simple IRA plans, the calculation is different. Your net earnings from self-employment are determined before subtracting any simple contributions you make for yourself. Your own simple contributions don't reduce the base used for calculating the contribution limit itself.
Huh. That is a subtle but potentially significant difference.
It absolutely can be. It's really important for self-employed individuals to use the correct definition based on the type of plan they have when figuring out their maximum allowable contribution and deduction.
Definitely something to double check. Thanks for clarifying those definitions. Now, thinking about potential downsides or costs, are there any additional taxes people should be aware of related to these plans? Things that might catch them by surprise.
Yes. Unfortunately, there are several potential additional taxes or penalties that can apply if rules aren't followed.
Okay, like what?
For SEP IRAs specifically, you can face additional taxes on excess contributions if you put in more than the legal limit for the year.
Right.
Also, early withdrawals. If you take money out before age 59 and a half, you generally owe regular income tax plus a 10% additional tax, although there are some exceptions to that 10% penalty.
The early withdrawal penalty.
Exactly. And then later in life, if you fail to take your required minimum distributions, RMDs, starting at the required age, currently 73 for most, there's a hefty penalty on the amount you should have withdrawn but didn't.
Okay. And we mentioned prohibited transactions earlier. Those can trigger taxes, too.
Yes. For SEP IRAs, engaging in a prohibited transaction can actually cause the entire IRA to be disqualified, meaning it's treated as distributed to you and becomes taxable. Or specific excise taxes might apply.
Yikes. What about simple IRAs and qualified plans? Similar potential penalties?
Broadly similar, yes. Qualified plans can also face excise taxes on excess contributions if not corrected properly. The 10% early withdrawal penalty before age 59 and a half generally applies to them too, again, with certain exceptions like death, disability, substantially equal, periodic payments, etc.
Okay.
Failure to meet the minimum funding requirements for plans that have them, like money purchase plans, can result in significant excise taxes. And prohibited transactions in qualified plans also trigger excise taxes, usually levied on the disqualified person who benefited.
And simple IRAs. Any unique penalties there?
Yes. Simple IRAs have a potentially harsher early withdrawal penalty. If you take money out within the first 2 years of initially participating in a simple IRA plan, the additional taxes increase from 10% to 25%.
Wow, 25%. That's a big deterrent to taking money out early.
It absolutely is. It strongly encourages leaving the money in, especially in those first couple of years. So yeah, understanding the contribution limits, withdrawal rules, RMD rules, and prohibited transaction rules is crucial to avoid these extra taxes and penalties across all plan types.
Definitely sounds like it pays to follow the rules.
Mm-hmm.
What about the ongoing paperwork, the reporting requirements for these different plans? Does it vary much?
It does vary quite a bit, yeah. Generally, the complexity increases as you move from SEP to simple to qualified plans.
Okay, how so?
SEP plans generally have the simplest ongoing reporting. Once established, the main requirement is for the employer to provide each participating employee with a statement showing the contributions made to their SEP IRA for the year. There's usually no annual filing requirement with the IRS or DOL for the employer unless they use the IRS model SEP form, Form 5305, and don't meet its conditions.
Okay, SEP sound pretty straightforward on reporting. What about simples?
Simple IRA plans are also relatively simple for the employer. There's generally no annual Form 5500 filing requirement. The main obligations are providing employees with notices about the plan each year, ensuring contributions are deposited correctly, and giving the financial institution holding the IRAs the necessary information.
Still fairly manageable then.
Yeah.
So qualified plans are where the heavier reporting comes in.
That's typically the case, yes. Most qualified plans, unless they are very small one-participant plans, are required to file a Form 5500 series return annually with the Department of Labor.
Form 5500, what does that involve?
It's a fairly detailed report providing information about the plan's financial condition, its investments, operations, funding levels, and participant counts. There are different versions, the full Form 5500 for larger plans, Form 5500SF, short form, for certain small plans, and Form 5500EZ for one-participant plans, like solo 401ks, with assets below a certain threshold.
Okay.
And it's worth noting that for plans required to file Form 5500 or 5500SF, electronic filing through the government's eFAS-2 system is generally mandatory.
E-filing required. Are there other forms besides the 5500 series?
Yes, depending on circumstances. For example, if you terminate a qualified plan, you generally need to file Form 5310, Application for Determination for Terminating Plan. And Form 8955 SSA is used to report participants who separated from service during the year but still have deferred vested benefits remaining in the plan.
Okay, so definitely more potential paperwork with qualified plans.
That's a fair summary, yes. The trade-off for higher contribution limits and more design flexibility is often increased administrative and reporting complexity.
Makes sense. And for our self-employed listeners, sole proprietors or partners, how do they actually claim the tax deduction for the contributions they make for themselves to these plans? Where does it go on the tax return?
Good practical question. Self-employed individuals, including partners, generally deduct their contributions made for themselves to SEP, Simple, and Qualified plans on Schedule 1 of their Form 1040, their individual income tax return. It's an above-the-line deduction, meaning it reduces their adjusted gross income, AGI.
Okay, Schedule 1, Form 1040. What if you're a partner in a partnership? How do you know how much you contributed or can deduct?
If you're a partner, the partnership itself will make the contribution on your behalf. The amount of the contribution made for you will typically be reported on the Schedule K-1, Form 1065, that the partnership provides you each year. You'll then use that information from the K-1 to calculate your allowable deduction, which you take on your personal Schedule 1.
Got it. So the K-1 is the key document for partners.
Exactly.
Well, this has been incredibly informative, a really detailed exploration of these crucial retirement plan options. For anyone listening who wants to dig even deeper, or needs guidance specific to their situation that we obviously couldn't cover, where should they turn for reliable resources?
The absolute primary resource should be the IRS itself. Their website, irs.gov, is packed with information.
Right.
You can find the full text of Publication 560, which we've been drawing from heavily today. They also have related publications like 590A and 590B, which dive deeper into IRAs, including SEP and Simple IRAs.
And all the forms, too, presumably.
Yeah, all the forms, all the instructions, freely available for download. Plus, the IRS website has useful tools, like their interactive tax assistant, which can sometimes help answer specific questions based on your inputs. It's a really valuable starting point.
Definitely. Any other suggestions?
Beyond the IRS, especially if you're navigating the complexities of qualified plans or trying to choose the best fit for your specific business and goals, consulting with a qualified professional is often a very good idea.
Like a financial advisor or a CPA?
Yes. Someone like a financial advisor, a CPA, or perhaps an ERISA attorney who specializes in retirement planning for small businesses. They can provide personalized advice tailored to your unique circumstances, help you understand the nuances, and ensure you set up and maintain the plan correctly.
Absolutely. That professional advice can be invaluable when making these really important long-term decisions. Okay, so just to quickly recap our deep dive today, We've really explored the foundational aspects of SEP, Simple, and Qualified Retirement Plans, specifically geared towards small businesses and the self-employed. We've looked at their unique features, the crucial rules around contributions, who can contribute how much and when, and of course the tax implications, both for the business and for the employees saving for retirement.
Yeah.
And I think it's become pretty clear that choosing the right plan isn't one size fits all. It really depends heavily on the specific needs of your business, its size, your employee situation, and your long-term goals.
That's exactly right. And, you know, considering those recent changes we talked about from the Secure 2.0 Act, particularly that new ability to have Roth options within both SEP and Simple plans.
Right, the Roth element.
It really does prompt some thinking, doesn't it? For you listening, how might this shift your own retirement savings strategy or maybe the preferences of your employees? For instance, if you have younger employees just starting out, that Roth option, paying taxes now for tax-free withdrawals later, might be a really significant draw for them.
Yeah, it adds a whole new dimension to the decision.
It does. It's definitely something to think about as you weigh your choices. Maybe ask yourself, what further questions do you have now about how these different plan structures with these traditional and Roth options might actually fit into your long-term financial picture or your business's compensation strategy.
That's a great point, a good food for thought question. This deep dive hopefully has given you a solid overview, a strong foundation. But as we've seen, the world of retirement planning is, well, it's extensive and it keeps evolving.
Constantly.
So we definitely encourage you to delve into those IRS resources we mentioned. Publication 560 is your friend here. And really strongly consider connecting with a qualified financial professional. They can help you tailor a plan that aligns perfectly with your individual situation and ultimately helps you build that secure financial future you're aiming for.
Well said.
Thanks so much for joining us on this deep dive.